One question, four expert witnesses. Welcome to The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Our podcasts are supported by advertising. BBC World Service. This is Helena Merriman with The Inquiry. This week, why do US cops keep killing unarmed black men? It's 9:30 in the morning, and 50-year-old Walter Scott, a Coast Guard veteran and father of four, is driving into a parking lot. A police car signals for him to pull over. His brake light is broken. Officer Slager gets out and checks his papers. Suddenly, Walter Scott makes a run for it. A passerby notices what's going on and starts filming. The video shows the two men in a scuffle. Walter Scott runs off. Officer Slager reaches for his gun, takes aim and fires. 8 times. An investigation later reveals that Walter Scott was wanted for arrest on a minor charge, but that he was unarmed. A few weeks ago, Officer Slager was charged with his murder. There have been other deaths too. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Freddie Gray. Yet there are many more. And alongside those deaths, an outpouring of anger. Amid that anger, one question. Why do US cops keep killing unarmed black men?
Part 1. Missing numbers.
I'm 24 years old. I'm a black man. It's incredibly depressing to see people just like me who have been killed.
This is Sam Sinyangwe, a researcher and activist who started a project called Mapping Police Violence.
I started the project really to provide answers in the wake of the shooting of Mike Brown on August 9th, 2014. I've documented and read the stories of 12-year-olds who were killed by police. It's very deep and heavy to read these stories, and yet it feels like the right work to do. It's important to tell their stories.
If you go looking for statistics on police shootings of unarmed black men, you'll be disappointed. There aren't any. That's because there's no official comprehensive tracking of police killings in the US. The FBI and others count some police officer-related deaths, but there are big gaps in the data.
There are statistics on all kinds of violent crimes, and yet when it comes to people being killed by police officers, there's no data on that. And that really, a light bulb went off in my head.
Sam Sinyangwe decided to collect his own.
I looked at those two crowdsourcing databases, which actually collected all of the names. What I then did was go through those articles, the media reports listing each of those people who was killed.
He counted 1,149 people of all ethnic groups killed by the police in 2014. But for his website, Sam Sinyangwe wanted more detail than just an overall number.
I actually identified whether they were armed or unarmed. I identified them by race, by looking at, one, if there was an obituary online of them, if there was another picture of them online.
And on the homepage, you have this map in which I'm looking at it now, and it has lots and lots of red pins dotted over the whole of the US. What does that map tell us?
It tells us that, you know, in the aftermath of Ferguson, there was this big question about, is this a pattern? Is this an isolated incident? And what this shows is that Ferguson is everywhere. You know, all over the country, you're seeing black people in particular being killed by police. And, you know, you can even click on, you know, the names of each of those pins and you can identify, you know, who was the person.
On this animated map of the U.S., red pins light up to indicate every time a black person was killed by a police officer last year. There are so many that it looks like a firework display across the country. Click on a pin and a name flashes up. George King, Aretha Lilly, Tommy Yancey, Yvette Smith, Tanisha Anderson, and many more. The youngest, 12. The oldest, 65. There's a special section on the website for those who were unarmed. Over 100 with their names and photographs. But Sam Sinyangwe says it's not the stories he's after. It's the numbers.
they show that black people are three times more likely to be killed by police in the United States than white people. They show that actually more unarmed black people were killed by police than unarmed white people last year. And that's taking into account the fact that black people are only 14% of the population here.
Sam Sinyangwe's numbers are being taken seriously. His conclusion from his data that African Americans are three times more likely to be killed by police than white people is supported by others. So what does he think is behind this?
I think it goes back to this question of, you know, how do they perceive young black men? How are black people in general perceived in America? And I think there's not as much value assigned to their lives.
Unarmed black men are being killed by American cops because of racism, he says. If that's the case, what's the evidence?
Part 2. Implicit bias.
I am a white, middle-class professional woman. I enjoy a great deal of privilege based on my demographics. And I saw in myself not only that privilege, but also implicit biases that I had about other groups.
As well as white and middle-class, Laurie Friedel is an associate professor of criminology at the University of South Florida. She's also very candid.
I certainly have the black crime implicit bias. I am more likely to see threat in African Americans than I would Caucasians.
She's someone who's thought a lot about bias over the years. It started when she became director of research at the Police Executive Research Forum in the late 90s.
The issue of racial profiling was the number one issue facing police. And I came to understand two things that didn't go together in my head. One, bias in policing was not just a few officers in a few departments. And I also came to understand that overwhelmingly the police in this country are well-intentioned people. And I couldn't put those two thoughts together in my head until I was introduced to the science of implicit bias.
Implicit bias. That's in contrast to the explicit kind, which you could just as well describe as overt prejudice. Instead, implicit bias is about something less conscious.
We all have implicit biases whereby we link groups to stereotypes, possibly producing discriminatory behavior. Even in individuals who are totally against prejudice, bias, and intolerance.
Take what's known as black crime implicit bias, a bias revealed by research carried out in the US. Showing that many link African Americans to crime, violence, and aggression. That research is partly based on experiments called Shoot, Don't Shoot.
The original Shoot, Don't Shoot studies has a subject sitting in front of a computer monitor, and photos pop up very quickly. And it's either going to have a white man or a black man. And then that man is either going to be having a gun in his hand or a neutral object, a cell phone or something like that. And the subject is told, if you see a threat, hit the shoot key, and if you don't see a threat, hit the don't shoot key.
What they've found is that people are quicker to shoot an unarmed black man than an unarmed white man. A report released in March looking at the use of deadly force by Philadelphia police supports the idea that cops are susceptible to implicit bias.
One of the things they looked at is what they called threat perception failure. The officer believed that the person was armed, and it turned out not to be the case. And this report found that these threat perception failures were more likely to occur when the subject was black.
80% of threat perception failures in Philadelphia involved African American suspects. But here's something that might surprise you. Black and Latino officers were just as likely to make these mistakes as white officers. You can't prove that it's implicit bias that's behind this, but Laurie Friedel sees a link.
Officers, like the rest of us, have an implicit bias linking blacks to crime. So the black crime implicit bias might be implicated in some of the use of deadly force against African Americans in our country.
So one of the reasons US cops are killing unarmed black men is that their implicit bias leads them to view black men as a threat, she says. But is this bias understandable? Although some argue that America's justice system over-criminalizes African Americans, the experience of cops on the street is often that black people are more likely to be responsible for crime.
An important message in our training is that stereotypes are based in part on fact. And we have to recognize this because in our country, people of color are disproportionately represented amongst the people who commit street crime. But we go on to say that does not give you license to treat every individual in a group as if they fit the stereotype. That's where we go wrong.
If implicit bias is partly to blame, then what's the solution? Laurie Friedel says the first step is for officers to acknowledge their implicit bias, then to challenge that bias by interacting with the people they're biased against. In other words, getting cops out on the streets of black neighbourhoods.
Maybe they're in a high crime, high minority area, making sure that they're playing basketball with the young kids, meeting with the business owners, the fathers that are trying to keep their kids out of the gangs. That positive contact can help reduce their biases. It can also impact on the stereotypes that those young kids have about police.
So why are US cops killing unarmed black men? We've heard that the implicit bias of many white, black and Latino officers might lead them to view black men as more of a threat than white. Now, that would explain why more African Americans might end up in a cell, but it doesn't explain why so many end up dead.
Part 3. Warrior Cops.
First rule of law enforcement is to go home at the end of your shift.
This is Seth Stoughton, a former cop.
The key principle is officer survival. That's what all of that training is designed to promote. But it ends up endangering civilians rather than preserving their safety.
Seth Stoughton was an officer in the police for 5 years, then left for the calmer confines of academia. He's now a law professor at the University of South Carolina. But he's not done with the police. He spent the last 3 years studying them, focusing on one aspect in particular, the use of force.
The warrior culture, the warrior mindset, the belief that police officers are soldiers engaged in battle with the criminal element, that mindset and the training has really contributed to some shootings that were most likely avoidable.
This warrior mindset doesn't begin on day one of police academy. It starts well before that.
This is the Orange County Sheriff's Academy.
It starts in police recruitment videos that show officers shooting rifles, strapping on hard body armor, using force. That attracts a particular type of candidate, and the police academy further entrenches this idea of the police warrior.
And how does it do that?
It teaches officers to be afraid by telling them that policing is an incredibly dangerous profession, to assume that everyone around them is a threat until proven otherwise. And I want to emphasize that. Officers are trained to view every encounter as a potential deadly force incident.
So give us an idea of some of the scenarios that you might be taught or worked through when you're a new recruit.
You walk up to a person who is loitering outside of a convenience store. Their hands are in their pockets. You, as the officer, begin talking to them, and without saying a word, they pull a gun out of their pocket and begin shooting you. You pull over a vehicle, and before you can even fully get out of your car, the driver of the vehicle gets out of their car, points a gun at you, and begins shooting at you, and so on.
I wonder if you can quantify this for us and give us a sense of how many hours of training will be spent working through these kind of scenarios.
An average of about 60 hours on deadly force, that is the use of firearms, and an average of just over 60 hours on self-defense. Compare that to de-escalation conflict resolution training. The average there is only 8 hours of training. And most of that is in a classroom.
So when officers are faced with a tense situation, they'll fall back on those physical skills, he says, the ones they feel more comfortable with. It's what some say happened in the case of Eric Garner, the black unarmed man selling cigarettes outside a shop. Officers approached, Eric Garner was verbally abusive, they put him in a chokehold, and he died soon after.
That's one example of the difference between de-escalation and a harder approach that the officers used more quickly than perhaps they needed to.
Seth Stoughton says this warrior cop mentality developed in the 70s after a few high-profile incidents where officers were killed. And it resulted in the police developing a very different attitude towards survival to that of the military.
When the military is designing a mission, they have in mind the fact that they're going to lose soldiers. The police profession has strongly repudiated that notion. No officer fatalities are acceptable.
It's as though, over the past few decades, a calculation has been made by the US police. That civilian deaths are an acceptable price to pay for no police deaths. But that calculation isn't final. Some states are changing their training, encouraging officers to find other ways of resolving situations without using force.
If all of the states had the same approach and the same numbers of officer-involved homicides as the best states, the states that had the fewest, we could expect about 300 to 600 lives to be saved every year.
So why do US cops keep killing unarmed black men? Our expert witnesses have built up a picture for us. A picture of a US cop, whether black, Latino or white, who's been trained to view every scenario as a potential threat. An officer who may well have an implicit bias against African Americans. But there's a missing piece in the picture. Why are so many black, unarmed men coming into contact with US cops in the first place?
Part 4. The bigger picture.
I spent 30 years as a member of the Chicago Police Department, 9 as chief in D.C., and now I'm 7.5 here in Philadelphia. It's my calling. It's what I was put on this earth to do.
Meet Charles H. Ramsey, a veteran of big city policing. Last year, he was handpicked by President Obama to co-chair a special task force looking at how to repair trust in the police. The raw anger in some American cities reminds him of the days when he started out as one of the first African-American police officers.
1968 was a period of time when there was a great deal of frustration, confusion. A lot of that was aimed at police, but it did cost me a few friendships.
Now, as a 65-year-old police commissioner who's reached the top, he has a bird's-eye view of the problem, and he doesn't accept that police are solely to blame.
No, I mean, we live in a society where everybody wants to point fingers, but we have a lot of deeply rooted societal problems. Poverty, education, the housing stock in many instances are poor. We got to deal with the issue of extreme poverty. I mean, Philadelphia, of the major cities in the United States, has the highest rate of poverty. You have an underground economy that supports many of these neighborhoods, drugs, prostitution, illegal sale of cigarettes.
It's crime born out of this poverty, he says, which helps explain why so many young African Americans are coming into contact with police in the first place.
Why are police in large numbers actually in some of these neighborhoods? We have to deal with the reality that there's a disproportionate amount of crime occurring in many of these same neighborhoods. So we need to find the right balance.
But how do you find the balance? Because while we focused on victims of police violence, of course, the police themselves are often victims, too.
On the other hand, we've also had several police officers shot and killed just during my brief time here in Philadelphia the past 7 years. I've had 8 officers killed in the line of duty. 5 were shot to death. So there is violence that takes place against police as well, and I think all that needs to be taken into consideration.
So he's been trying something new in Philadelphia. He divided the city into separate areas, assigning a team to each one.
They have monthly community meetings to talk about problems of crime and disorder. New cadets that come out of the academy are assigned to foot patrol right away. They don't automatically go into cars. And I do that so that they actually get to know people in these challenged communities, good folks that are there and trapped in certain conditions.
It's back to that idea we heard about earlier, getting groups who hold bias against each other together to challenge those stereotypes. And the strategy might be working. Crime has come down under his watch. But that's not to say there aren't still problems. A recent report from the Department of Justice criticised Philadelphia police for their use of force. It's why Commissioner Ramsey's in favour of new training that gives officers skills in de-escalation as well as armed response.
Putting them in scenarios where they have to make decisions, they have to exercise good judgment, and being able to critique that so that when they are in these real live situations, their reaction, their response is really more consistent with what the actual threat is.
So why are U.S. cops killing unarmed black men? Imagine a street in a black neighborhood with high levels of poverty and crime. A cop turns up to deal with a situation involving a black man. He instinctively views that man as a threat, and as the situation deteriorates, his warrior cop training kicks in. He shoots. The solution? We've heard that it's about training, to counter both implicit bias and the warrior cop mentality. But it's about poverty too. No quick fix solutions then, but Samson Yangwe says there's an important, achievable first step.
There's something in the United States called Vision Zero. And Vision Zero is a commitment by mayors to achieve zero traffic fatalities in a specified time frame. And yet, we haven't seen mayors step up and make clear commitments to reducing the level and eliminating the level of police violence in their communities. And I think that says a lot about the relative value that they place on those constituents' lives.
If there's a commitment to both count and reduce the numbers of those killed by cars, why no commitment to count and reduce the number of those killed by cops? It wouldn't solve the problem, but it would send an important message. Someone is watching.
This inquiry was presented by Helena Merriman and produced in London by me, James Fletcher, and Phoebe Keane. Next week, we'll be tackling the tough questions around world football's governing body and asking, who can fix FIFA? If you've got a burning question you'd like us to answer, demand an inquiry on Facebook or get in touch on Twitter. We're at BBC The Inquiry.